obsessed with all things ovine, there is seriously something about sheep and always something new to learn about keeping, breeding and farming them. Welcome to the Sheep Show podcast. I'm Jill Noble from Holston Valley Farm and Sheep Stud and your host. The Sheep Show podcast exists to help you, no matter where you are in the world, what sheep you breed, what size your flock is. This podcast will help your sheep knowledge and your shepherding confidence grow. And it's a two-way street. I love to hear from you and find out how your sheep journey is going. Contact me via Instagram at Holston Valley Farm or via email jill@holstonvalleyfarm.com.au. Come along on this episode as we explore the amazing world of sheep and sheep farming together. Hey, sheep friends, just before we get into this episode, I wanted to get you up to speed with what's been going on and where I've been. I have been working on some content for you over on YouTube, content that is sheep related and content that is small farm related generally, so how you can build and grow confidence in and on a small farm. So I would love you to head over there. Just go to YouTube, Holston Valley Farm, and you'll see all the videos, what we've been up to, and the content we've been creating, the tips, the farming tips that we've been creating for you over there. And please, I would love it if you could watch the videos. Let me know what you think. Make a comment. If you like them, please like them. And of course, I would love if you would consider subscribing to me over there on YouTube. That would be very much appreciated. So thank you so much for considering that. In the meantime, enjoy this episode from Greg as he talks about managing wild dogs. Hopefully this will help you in the lead up to lambing 2023. Welcome everyone to this episode of the Sheep Show podcast. And today I have a wildlife ecologist for us. With me today is Greg Mifsud. Greg is based in Toowoomba in Queensland, and he actually works with the National Wild Dog Action Plan as a National Wild Dog Management Coordinator. And Greg's got a background managing invasive species, and particularly, of course, with the focus for us on predator management for sheep and lambs, not just in Australia, but anywhere at all. Greg's just been telling me about his trips over to the US as well. So all those US listeners, lots of things here from Greg. So today we're going to really focus on predator management for sheep and lambs, focusing on dogs, foxes, and anything else that Greg can help us with. So thanks for joining me, Greg.
No worries, Jill.
Great stuff. So tell us, first of all, a little bit about the wild dog plan and what the wild dog plan does.
Yeah, so I've been in this role now, a number of different titles, for about 15 years. The project commenced back in 2007 because there was a huge amount of angst and anger around the issue of wild dogs, particularly. Some of your listeners may know, and from being from Leongatha, we've got significant amounts of public land and state land interspersed with private land and sheep grazing properties where traditionally, you know, we've had wild dogs and dingoes that tend to use those bushland corridors and then attack sheep on the periphery. And at the time, communication wasn't good. There was a lot of, as I said, angst about the fact that, you know, sheep were being killed and dogs weren't being controlled. And we really needed a more adaptable model where landholders and producers were actively involved in how management was delivered. And we created this process called a nil tenure management process. And I was actually at Jindabyne with Queensland Parks and Wildlife at the time when we rolled this out just across the border in the Snowy River region. Mm-hmm. And that whole process was about taking the land tenures off the map. Dogs don't obey boundaries. Most pest animals don't obey boundaries. They don't obey your boundary fence. They don't obey imaginary lines on maps that demarcate, you know, one state from another. And so really it was about using satellite imagery to look at the landscape, look at where stock were being killed and attacked, where dogs were likely to be moving through that landscape, and then looking at, well, what control can each of those stakeholders put in place to limit that risk? And that became our nil tenure model. And the last part of that process was to put the lines back on the map, so to speak, and say, okay, well, who's going to be responsible for what? And what that did was it removed the blame of whose dogs they were to, well, their dogs are moving across the whole landscape. So they could be anyone's today, they could be yours tomorrow, they could be Joe Blow's the next day. So it's no point affording blame about who owns the dogs. It's going to be a community management issue. So let's just get together and look at how we can sort that out. And that process in Jindabyne and in parts of the Snowy Mountains where we had significant conflict was extremely successful. And it was decided back then through the current organisation I'm employed through, the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions, decided that we needed to roll that approach out nationally and manage it at a different scale in different states. And that really was what my role became. So that process has then evolved into what became the national plan. So after 6 years of working at a local and regional level, delivering those sorts of management outcomes, it was actually industry that said, well, we need to capture this as a national strategy. And Wool Producers Australia actually funded the development of the first plan back in 2014. And what that did was it just solidified everyone's engagement and involvement in this process under a national strategy, just like any other biosecurity or livestock production strategy. And what that did was secure, I guess, the approach we take on ground. And that was what industry wanted. They wanted to be actively involved in the decision making. And as a consequence, actively involved in the management options, and it's been extremely successful.
Right.
I'm pleased to say that, you know, particularly in your neck of the woods, we've gone from public meetings that were basically like lynch meetings, waiting to see which government officer they were going to string up the next that day, to now we have field days. We talk about other production issues that affect livestock production and pasture management, and dogs and predation is just one of those issues, not just the sole focus of everyone's in, you know, thinking. So, yeah. And we sit around the end of the day and we have a beer and we have a snag around a barbecue, which is a much better than trying to look at where your escape route is going to be and get the car started before everyone leaves the room.
Isn't it amazing what good old-fashioned communication and collaboration can actually achieve?
Absolutely. And I think that was, you know, I'm not going to be kidding. I went from working in Queensland and went down to New South Wales working for Parks, and you know, I was threatened to be shot at twice in the first week of the job. That was the level of angst that was involved in the, well, it was just Parks. There's a whole history there, and this is what people often don't understand, that there's often a whole background to the conflict at hand, and unless you get to know the stakeholders and work out what that is, it's very hard to go forward. So you know, there was 30 years of angst about, you know, the park being resumed from public-private ownership, you know, high country grazing. The last straw was the dogs coming out of park killing my sheep. So it was a very different landscape for me from Queensland, where people hung a bit of shit on you about being a parkie, but you still had a beer with them at the pub at the end of the day. To go from that to where we are now is a really massive achievement, and a lot of credit's due to everyone involved for taking that on.
Brilliant stuff. What are the statistics on wild dog predation in Australia in particular?
Yeah, look, it varies considerably between states and nationally, but we're looking at around an $89 to $110 million loss, livestock loss alone. The impacts on wool production sit at around $22-24 million, and attacks on and sheep meat losses about 4.3. But they're extremely conservative. They're based on very conservative economic models. And what's vastly different from the US in particular is that our herds are so large, and in some places the mobs are so big, and in rangeland conditions, you can't tell exactly how many animals are physically being killed unless you find them.
Yeah.
Whereas my experience from America is because the federal government manages their predator program, so every stock attack is validated by an officer. So they have very clear indications of exactly how many animals are likely to have been killed.
Wow.
Whereas we don't tend to have that, so we have to rely on this economic modelling to look at, you know, what sort of impact we're having as an industry in economic dollars rather than individual animals. At a smaller scale, for instance, in Victoria, we've had nearly an 80% decline in requests for assistance and stock losses in the last 10 years as a result of going to this much more cooperative and coordinated approach to management. So we do have some individual figures there, but they're about requests for assistance rather than actual individual animals killed. So, but I can say categorically, you know, in some parts of the country that, you know, that the impact of dogs on top of other market forces has really led to a decimation of sheep production in some landscapes. And in some places it's so bad that it's forced people out of breeding cattle into fattening operations because they can't tolerate the losses on cattle. So it can be quite
from a predation on calves in particular.
Yep, absolutely. As well as disease.
Yeah.
Neospora is another issue. So that causes abortion storms in cattle. So in some, particularly up in that north coast, high rainfall areas, a lot of people have gone out of breeding and into fattening. So it's quite large.
Yeah, absolutely. And interesting just to see the way, you know, the different countries just manage it differently and track it. How would you know if you have wild dogs in your area? Because I remember when we moved here, one of the first things we asked some of the neighbors were there wild dogs before we sort of decided to be mad enough to get sheep. What do you look for?
So there's a couple of things. So depending on which state you're in, so the difference in Australia is that each state has different regulatory responsibilities and different legislation. So you have different organisations responsible for pest management. Most states will have at least a website that identify where their pest distributions are. So you can go and have a look via state government web pages if you look up wild dogs and wild dog management. But alternatively, you could go to whatever relevant authority you've got. So in Victoria, it would be through probably the Agriculture Department or Department of Environment, Land Protection and Water. But then you've also got local governments and others. So people know they have regional biosecurity plans and they have identified, you know, whether you've got dogs within your region, I guess. But at a local scale, you know, looking for signs. So a big part of what we've been doing over the last 15 years is really making people aware of what to look for in terms of wild dogs and their presence, because quite often, as yourself, you move into an area, you're not familiar with what to look for. Some of the key signs are, you know, if you've used to seeing kangaroos in your back paddock and wallabies around, all of a sudden they just disappear. They're not going to hang around if there are dogs active. Signs of your sheep being really agitated is another key one, particularly around your own working dog. So if you've got, you know, sheep that, you know, are usually really calm and cool and collected with your working dogs and all of a sudden they're flighty and quite nervous and agitated, that's a really key sign that there's something around. But if you jump on our National Wild Dog Action Plan webpage or PestSmart, which is another website, we've got guides. There's glove box guides in there that provide you with a whole range of information about what to look for, including the differences in tracks and what to look for. So instead of driving around the paddock looking at the grass,
look down.
On the way back, just look down before you drive over that track. Look down. You know, sandy creek crossings, muddy patches. Bolt holes under fences where kangaroos and things move. Like, they're all the same sorts of corridors that dogs and foxes. So so it's just getting into that mindset of looking at the landscape and features within it rather than focusing on looking at your stock in the paddock. So we've done a lot of work trying to impress upon people what to look out for. And in a lot of cases, it's prevented them being severely impacted because they've got on the front foot quite early.
Yeah, what about scat? Can you see differences in the air?
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, dogs will use sign mark, you know, mark sites like foxes do and like your own dogs will do. So another sign to look for is if you've got your own working dogs and they're spending a lot of time sniffing around particular posts or tussocks and marking, you know, they'll respond territorially just like a wild dog will to another dog in their patch. So keeping an eye on that. And then usually once you see that, if you look around, you will often find scats. They're much bigger than foxes. Foxes are really skinny, extremely twisted up sort of dried out scats, whereas dogs are quite larger. But you'll notice if it's a wild dog, there'll be hair and bits of bone and stuff in it. as opposed to a domestic dog, which is being fed on, you know, kibble and stuff, which is really just, you know, quite crumbly domestic dog crap, which people go and pick up all the time. If it doesn't look, you know, it's got hair and everything in it, then it's a real sign that there's definitely some activity.
Yeah.
But you'll notice your own dogs are as good an indicator as anything. If they start really behaving territorially and start marking everything and spending a lot of time around certain tussocks or fence posts, have a closer inspection and see what else you can see.
Mm-hmm. Is it true, there's an old wives' tale that, you know, if you have dogs on your property and they mark that territory, that they will keep other dogs and foxes away? Is that right, or is it the opposite, that no?
No, it's not. Look, territorial boundaries are just to notify others that you're in the vicinity.
Yeah.
Until right before breeding season, where maybe there'll be some territoriality, but they don't exclude other animals. They're just signposts to let people know you're present.
Yeah.
You certainly don't want to run into each other on a dark night on a track somewhere, but that's the whole point of marking. So if you come up to a tussock and there's a really fresh marking on there, well, you probably won't go any further in that direction. So, to be honest, we use dog urine as probably the number one lure for trapping.
Uh-huh.
So it certainly doesn't exclude them. There was a notion, even with guardian dogs and the use of maremmas, and we've done some research on this, that people believe that maremmas did establish a territory which then excluded dingoes and wild dogs. What we actually found that wasn't the case, that the maremmas are actually herding dogs. So they will just move the flock away from where the danger or perceived danger is. They don't exclude dogs from there at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we put radio collars, satellite collars on dingoes and maremmas to see how they operated within the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And they often overlapped considerably. So
wow.
It's not an exclusion. It's more just about movement. And that's where dog control or dingo control programs are important, because maremmas and the guardian dogs can only deal with a certain density of predators in the landscape. So if there's too many of them, then you tip the balance in favour of the predator.
Mm.
So in particularly in a Victorian context and those eastern New South Wales and places, if we don't have ongoing management programs on the periphery of those state lands and bushland areas, that the dog densities get so high that, you know, a guardian animal or guardian dog just can't manage.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly where you've got broken country, and this is something that I learned from America, I mean, they have full-time range riders and herders that live with their sheep 24/7 and the dogs. And once you get into that broken country, it's much harder for the dogs, the guardian dogs, to look over all the stock, because, as you know, they start moving out into smaller groups here and there. And in broken country and timbered country, it's much harder for the guardian dogs to keep an eye on everybody and much easier for the odd wild dog to slip in and tackle one here and there. So,
yeah.
They all have their place, but we talk about integrated management, and that's about trying to apply as many tools as possible, in the landscape so that you can manage that impact.
Mm-hmm. And those things that you mentioned there about the wild dogs, you know, with the hair and the bones and the scat, would that also be the same for dingoes?
Yep, absolutely. So I guess I'll clarify.
Mm.
Under the Wild Dog Action Plan, we consider a wild dog to be any of the above, a dingo, a domestic dog, or any of their hybrids. So there's a lot of DNA stuff floating around out there at the moment claiming that there's a lot more dingoes in the landscape than what we think.
Mm-hmm.
As you are a show breeder Wilshire horns?
It is, yeah.
And a lot of other people out there that know breed standards,
yeah.
The majority of dogs we're dealing with are in the vicinity of between 50 and 75% dingo.
Oh, wow.
So that means there's 25 to 50% domestic dog. They're hybrids, basically.
Yeah.
They might be dingo-like, but then, you know, most border collie Kelpie crosses are either dingo, or Kelpie-like or border collie-like.
Yeah.
So it's really a bit semantics. But at the end of the day, any wild living dog that threatens an asset, whether that's livestock or even native fauna, we will manage that dog to reduce the impact that it's likely to cause. So, and, you know, as I said, you can't tell from looking at an animal whether it's 99% purebred dingo or 50% purebred dingo. So from that perspective, We manage any wild living dog that's likely to cause harm to either your sheep or someone's cattle, or it could be a bridle nail-tailed wallaby in central Queensland, or the northern hairy-nosed wombat, which is threatened by dog predation as one of its key threatening processes.
Mm-hmm.
So just to clear that up.
Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful. Really helpful.
Because I think
It's good for us to know that, even though dingoes are seen as native, there's still a management approach to them. Because I guess they're only in certain areas of Australia anyway. Pure dingoes would be in really either desert or arid country or very bushy country, I'm thinking.
Yeah, so getting to the dingo debate. We've got maps online that you can go and have a look at. But, so the majority of, where you have the largest density of closer to purebred dingoes are in those remote areas.
Mm.
In eastern Australia, where we've had over 200 years of European settlement and domestic dogs, the dingo is just a dog. It's an ancient breed of dog. It readily crossbreeds with any of our domestic breeds. Yeah. So it's not surprising that in eastern Australia, the majority of dogs, wild living dogs that we're dealing with are dingo crosses of some description.
Mm-hmm.
But as you know, you often get throwbacks. So you could have 2-3 quarter bred ones that will throw one purebred out of, 6 or 7 in a litter. So you will get still, 90 to 90% dingoes crop up just out. We'll get back to my uni days, Mendelian genetics. You're going to get one out of 8 that's going to possibly be purebred.
Wow, that's amazing.
But ultimately, as I said, we manage their impacts and we manage the risk of them causing an impact wherever they might be. So,
and then foxes are a completely different genus species?
Genus.
So they can't breed with dogs?
No.
No.
That's correct.
Yeah.
No. So foxes are completely different. So different genus. Can't breed with dogs, whole different life cycle, more of a scavenging sort of mesopredator type animal. So, and once again, in terms of their impact, foxes have a very limited time frame to impact on sheep production. So, very small lambs, they're not strong enough and capable enough to kill a healthy, 5 to 8 kg lamb, but they will pick off young ones.
Right.
Random, whereas dogs are completely different. They will predate on all age groups and age classes of sheep, and that's what makes wild dogs and dingo attacks so debilitating for a sheep producer, because they're not only attacking lambs, they're attacking ewes, they're attacking wethers, and they're attacking rams at times. So if you've got a dog problem, then none of your livestock are safe, basically. None of your age groups are safe, whereas with foxes, and to a lesser extent, feral pigs, they're really only going to prey on lambs in that short window. If you're doing program joining, it might only be a 2 to 3 week window where that risk is prevalent. And if you do sufficient control leading into your lambing, then you can reduce your fox numbers and manage that loss.
Yeah.
And whereas dogs are also debilitating in the fact that they don't often eat what they kill. So particularly when you've got young dogs, so around February, March, when those dogs that were bred the year before are becoming independent. If any of you guys have, I'm sure you've had, litters of dogs and pups around the house, they get to that sort of 4 to 5 months old, they're just looking for mischief, they've got energy to burn. And there's nothing more fun than balling up a mob of sheep in the corner and chasing the one that runs away, bleating and carrying on, jumping in the air, and just triggers that flight response, triggers their attack response, and they'll run after it, bite its hamstring it, and then come back and chase the next one. And so, we see really large impacts, could be anything from 10 to 20, 30 a night in some cases. 60 in a couple of weeks is not uncommon to be bitten and killed, and half the time they die from stress or have to be put down from their injury. So that, to me, is why I've been in this job for so long, because it is, it's such a heightened emotional response from landholders to see stock that they've put all that effort into being mauled and damaged like that. We've actually undertaken some clinical and psychological assessments of this issue. You know, sort of explains why I was being threatened to be shot at Jindabyne all those years ago. But there's an impact of event scale rating that people, psychologists and psychiatrists do to look at the impact of a major traumatic event on someone's life. So cardiac arrest, major traffic, motor trauma and things like that. So we did surveys with landholders from Western Queensland, Gippsland and South Australia who lived in areas where they were under constant threat from dog attack. And we found that those landholders were suffering post-traumatic stress disorder, very similar to that of a returned serviceman.
Wow.
That's how high the emotional and mental strain is for landholders that are consistently having to deal with dogs attacking livestock. So,
wow.
You know, that's quite significant and puts things into context about why this issue is so important to me, I suppose, in terms of why I do it.
And
why it's such a benefit to producers and communities on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just astonishing, isn't it? And I know, you know, a lot of us, and I still talk to people who literally sleep with their sheep when they're lambing. Like they actually do. It's not...
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a very concerning time. So you mentioned there how the dogs basically play or chase the sheep, and obviously at particular ages the dogs are even more kind of keen to do that. Yeah. What, and you mentioned then foxes, this 5 to 8 kilo lamb. So again, that's something I've heard. You know, if the lamb is 8 kilos, a fox will not be able to actually be strong enough to bring that lamb down. And what do you think?
No. Yeah, no, that's very true. So, I mean, even after a few days, you know, a week or 2 weeks with lambs and they get to sufficient size, they're too mobile, they're too strong to handle. They really sort of pick out weaker animals. They'll hang around and pick out those young animals that are just hitting the ground. Yeah. And so, look, if you can reduce your fox densities leading into your lambing period, that's super important because the densities of foxes in some landscapes are quite high. You can have up to 40 to 300 within 5 to 10 k's of your property. So leading into your lambing period, you know, we've been running some producer demonstration sites around Mansfield where, you know, been encouraging baiting for up to 4 to 5 weeks prior to lambing.
Yeah.
Small numbers of baits, not a lot of baits, but small numbers, key locations, and replacing them as they go.
Mm-hmm.
So for every one you take out, there'll be another one to fill the hole.
Yeah.
And basically what you're trying to do is keep feeding them the baits until there's no more to fill in the hole.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're dealing with then is, you know, really low numbers, and that's generated between a 3% and a 5% increase in lamb survival in some of those cases.
Amazing.
It's a minimal investment. It's a minimal investment for the return you get. You know, a bucket of baits is a couple of $100 and, you know, doing it properly and doing it a bit more conscientiously leading up to lambing will get you a much better outcome than just putting out a whole heap of baits just before they're due to hit the ground.
Yeah. Just on that, we actually have a property up in Mansfield as well. Is there wild dog activity up there?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So whereabouts? Oh, we'll talk about that
later. Yeah, we can talk about that later. But yeah. It's just outside, about 10 minutes outside town, sort of towards the Swan Pool end of things. We haven't got any stock there yet, but we've already sort of thinking exactly what you were just saying, trying to sort of think ahead.
Yep.
The good thing is there's a neighbor. He's running 10,000 sheep on 5,000 acres. So obviously you would hope that other property, just like you're saying there, and I know with the baits, if you can have that coordinated management with everyone, for sure, it's really, really good. Yeah, I have to say that was one of the things I did go and get my in Australia, and it'd be different, of course, in different locations, but in Australia we've got this bait that Greg's talking about. It's called 1080 bait, and you can get a license. You need to get a chemical user's permit, right, and then a 1080 license to and exactly what Greg's talking about. You don't put down too many because the foxes will sort of cache it and
yes.
Yeah.
So I'll While we're talking about 1080,
Go for it.
It's very controversial internationally.
Okay.
It's been banned in the US and other places, and I think Australia and New Zealand are probably the two main users of the solution.
Yeah.
Sodium fluoroacetate is the active ingredient. 1080 was the catalog number when they were testing it years ago. But it is native to Australia, so yeah. It actually occurs naturally in 38 species of our native plants over here. Our native fauna are quite resistant to it, so even our largest carnivorous marsupial, which is a tiger quoll, we've done trials and basically we can't kill one with 1080.
Mm-hmm.
We use extremely small amounts, and that was something the USDA guys were amazed by when I did a presentation over there, that we use 0.2 of a milliliter of solution, which is only a 0.2 a milliliter of 36 milligram solution. So we're talking minute amounts. And the beauty of 1080 is that it's being a natural toxin. It's eaten by bacteria in the soil and dilutes to harmless compounds when it gets water on it. So for our landscape, it is the most effective tool, one of the most effective tools we've got, but we simply cannot afford to lose, hence the regulations around its use and training people. So, and we're in unlike in the US where they have such a large suite of predators and scavengers, and where 1080 was banned over there because they used it in what we wouldn't call best practice manner back in the 70s. It was banned because of its impact on non-target animals. So we're very target specific in the way we use it over here, and hence the reason we've got some of our native fauna are bouncing back in areas because of its use. So without it, our conservation programs would suffer significantly as well.
Isn't that really amazing when you actually look at that? You know, it's a quite a ingenious sort of way of really targeting.
Yep.
And it will work on wild dogs too?
It does work on wild dogs, yes. So depending on the strength we use, but wild dogs, foxes and cats, carnivores with very direct digestive systems are the most susceptible to it, which means we can use minute concentrations to achieve an outcome. So because it's broken down by bacteria, we need larger doses for things like ruminants, like feral pigs and rabbits and things like that. You need much higher doses, but for feral introduced predators and dogs, we don't need to use very much at all, which is why we have so little impact on our native fauna. And we usually use it in meat or a meat substitute, so we exclude a lot of other animals that are likely to eat it.
What about I know a lot of people think that eagles are going to be harmed with 1080 by
No, not with dog strength or fox strength 1080 baits. They would have to eat, I think it's three times their body weight in one sitting to be impacted. Because they have a crop and a very mechanical digestive system, just like the chickens have crops and they eat pebbles, and a lot of the food sits in there and there's bacteria and all that sort of stuff in there, that bacteria rapidly breaks down whatever 1080 is in those
thinking.
Baits.
Yeah, that's what I was
same
thinking.
With goannas. Goannas need to eat 55 times their weight. It's ridiculous the amount of 1080 that those animals would have to eat or consume to be impacted. So that's why we desperately need to maintain its use and in our landscapes.
I think you're right, it's very controversial, but as you say it's really improved the conservation efforts for some of our native animals in particular, and marsupials in particular. So and I guess I'm sure in every country there's introduced species, but when you talk about foxes in particular, and then of course the wild dogs, these are introduced species apart from the dingo.
Yep. Yeah. Well, the dingo came across here 4,000 years ago.
He's introduced too.
It might be naturalized, but we won't get into that one. That's controversial. Let's just say naturalized.
Naturalized. It's a great way to look at it. This is interesting when you talk to someone who really knows what's going on rather than perhaps pop culture, which thinks, the poor dingoes and things like that. You know, I guess it would make sense, wouldn't it? Because given the amount of marsupial life and little native rats and things like that, you know, they probably would never have come to fruition if we had such a large native dingo, I suppose, roaming around.
Well, so we used to have lots of carnivorous marsupials. So we had Australia broke off from the supercontinent before placental mammals reached us. So we never had any placental mammals at all. So all of our fauna were marsupial, even the rodents. So we did get some rodents that got here naturally, floating on debris and stuff from Indonesia. And we had thylacines, or Tasmanian tigers, Tassie devils, and we've got spotted quolls. Mm. So we do have a large suite of carnivorous marsupials, but the larger ones died out as Australia got drier. It probably coincided with the dingo arriving and being outcompeted. So we did have our own predators, but they got outdone by a bigger, faster, more reproductively successful carnivore that also shared its lifestyle with humans, so with indigenous communities in some cases as well. So,
indeed.
So we did have our own predators. We just didn't have any as quite as efficient as the ones we got now.
So, and apart from baiting, then you talked about integrated management. So, what other things can farmers do, and what other things does the national wild dog management plan do to reduce or manage, and again, whether it's foxes or wild dogs?
Yeah, so look, we've taken a lot of lessons from our northern hemisphere cousins. So we do a lot of trapping. Trapping is another key tool. It's much more time consuming and labor intensive, so it's something we generally do in a much more targeted fashion.
Right.
So once again, getting to know the signs and looking for corridors. Dogs in particular, and to a lesser extent foxes, are creatures of habit, and they'll use certain landscape features over and over again, whether they've been born there, bred there, just traveling through, things like ridge lines, creek gullies, fire trails. So once you get to know the activity patterns and the locations, then you can often set up either like a permanent bait station there, or you could possibly, if the dogs are currently there and active, then you could, we do a lot of training to teach people how to use traps effectively for both foxes and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can also use, fencing, electric and exclusion fencing, netting fencing.
Yeah.
We still encourage the use of guardian animals, particularly for foxes.
Yeah.
And once again, guardian dogs and marimas do work quite well, provided that there's a well-managed dog program in the background maintaining populations. So that's where I'm talking about integration. It's about no single method. And, I'm an avid hunter, when people say, oh, we'll just go and shoot them all, I mean, that's just complete bullshit.
Yeah.
Well,
it's one strategy, but
it's simply a strategy, but it's extremely opportunistic. You have to be there and on the spot. So you have to rely on those other tools that are in a landscape and can take out animals when you're not present. And that's where trapping comes in. And that's where the use of baits and those sorts of things. We also have an ejector device. So the Americans have been using call it an M44 ejector. Over here, we call it a canid pest ejector. It's a mechanical device that's nailed into the ground that has a plunger and a mechanism. So when the animal pulls on the bait at the top, the toxin's contained inside a capsule. And when it's pulled, sets it off, and the plunger goes up through the capsule and squirts the poison into their mouth. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And for your situation and potentially, on smaller blocks where security of that toxin is really important, so, baits don't get moved and shifted somewhere where you don't expect them to be, these ejector devices work quite well because they can't be moved. The other thing we encourage in those landscapes is tying your baits up, put a piece of wire through it and just tie it to the fence. So you can physically see it's been removed. Mm-hmm. You can't just get shit. And it gives you that security that, I grew up near Ballarat, and unfortunately quite often when a working dog did get baited, it was usually in the paddock that had baits put in it, but a fox had kindly shifted one for you and you had no idea. So we really encourage muzzles, for the sake of a $15 or $16 muzzle from Elders. get your dogs used to it. If you're going to have ongoing fox programs and ongoing dog control community, it's really the best insurance you've got against losing your working dogs. Mm-hmm. We've also got videos from, you know, leading dog trainers about how to use muzzles and how to get your dog used to having their muzzle on. We've got places in Queensland where the dogs know they don't come off the chain unless they've got their muzzle on. They hop up on the motorbike and have their muzzle put on before they get released.
They just know.
So it really is just part of that training ritual, that habituation. And in fact, you know, we know what's going to be routine. That's what I'm looking for. Mm. It's about routine. Working dogs get the muzzles on them all the time, because they could pick up anything out there that you know, potentially. It doesn't have to be a bait. It could be anything that makes them crook or, who knows. So,
indeed.
So, yeah, so that's when we talk about integrated management. It's about applying all those tools, working with your neighbours. We have a really interesting platform called Feral Scan and Wild Dog Scan and Fox Scan. Mm. Have you seen that? So you can actually work with your neighbours and see when things are active. Mm-hmm. You can set up a group. And so if you see a dog on your property and record it, all your neighbours will get told that it's there if they're part of your group, so they can be prepared for it to come across. Mm. We're trying to do as much as we can to make management and communication with neighbours about how to go about dog control as easy as possible, because part of that frustration and angst we dealt with in the early days was that also that feeling of isolation. You know, I'm here in it by myself. There's no one to help. There's no one to support me with my issue today. And that's really been a major change and shift in the way we do things now. Yeah. There's 24 wild dog management groups, for instance, just in Victoria alone. Wow. We've got multiple ones in New South Wales and Queensland. So people are working way more collectively now as a group to manage this issue rather than having to deal with it on their own and suffering all of that stress.
Brilliant. I love that. That's great. And I mean, I think even locally with us, not everyone has sheep, but a lot of people do care for the local wildlife. So, you know, there's something you've got in common with your neighbor, even if they're not breeding animals or they're, so that you know. So
yeah, they might not be making a living from livestock, but a lot of people have got a couple of pet sheep or, you know, even poultry is another major target for foxes in particular. So if you can find that common ground, the best practices out there, there's a lot of answers to people's concerns about how to do this stuff. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of support locally through, you know, various statutory authorities and government agencies. So I guess my advice is, go looking for the information. It's all out there. We've been developing best practice around this for a long time. And once you find that contact and can make contact with certain people, then particularly for sheep producers trying to convince a neighbour to do something about foxes or dogs when they don't have an issue and they're concerned about other aspects, use that information and that support from other entities to try and work with those neighbours and allay their fears and get them involved.
Love it. Great stuff. Absolutely. And I'll get you to share some of those resources in just a second. Just going back, you mentioned there the routine and the dogs with the routine. So if you interrupt the dog's routine with something like noises or shooting or even lights, whether they're torches or these fox lights, do those things help?
Possibly for a short term. So the fox lights, I don't think, we haven't had anyone mention real great deal of success with dogs and fox lights, I think, and particularly in different landscapes. I mean, they're used to cars travelling on roads and they're used to seeing that sort of disturbance. They're living in and amongst people. So particularly with dogs, I think they get used to them pretty quick.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, if you take a pot shot at a dog and you probably give it a good scare and they might change their pattern for a little while. Don't forget, these things have pretty big home ranges. You know, it can be up to 20 square kilometres. So they might just go and hang out somewhere else for a bit of time and eventually come back. So the very short-term defences, I suppose, or very short-term effects and impacts on their behaviour, but, you know, generally they'll come back to doing what they do and get back into their routine. So. Ultimately, you know, I think you have to be a little bit more proactive in most cases in terms of your management.
Yeah, Yeah, I think that's good advice. And then I know we talked there about how, you know, good it is if you collaborate and work with your neighbors. But what if your neighbor's dog comes onto your onto your property? And, you know, even if they're a very placid dog, but, you know, you get nervous, or again, you know, you're sort of stressed about it. What rights do you have as a landowner? And I know there's a lot of myths going along. You can shoot anything that comes onto your property, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, each state is different in their local laws around domestic dogs. I think, well, if the dog's directly threatening your livestock and you're at risk, you know, you're catching it in the act, basically, I think you do have to take action.
Yeah.
And that's where, and on occasions, you know, that dog might need to physically be shot, because once they get into that mode, you know, they're not going to come to you when they're chasing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, look, I mean, diplomatic is always the best route, an option. You know, I think you have to take the diplomatic approach if you're seeing people's dogs in the neighbouring properties.
Yeah.
Not just from your, I think that the issue is also that, you know, if you are baiting, I mean, the risk is that they might lose their dog.
I know, that's the thing.
As much about the welfare about their dog as it is about the welfare of your sheep. So I think
taking that
path is usually the best one. Mm. And, yeah, I think, once again, you have to really go to your local authorities and find out what are my rights here at the moment. I think that's always a good option to cover your backside just in case something does go pear-shaped. Yeah. Say, look, we've taken all the appropriate steps. Following all your regulations around your baiting use, and as you've done the training, you'd be aware that you have to put signage and stuff up. So,
I
mean, you really do have to make sure that you cover all your bases and make sure that you're rock solid if something does go pear-shaped.
Yeah, exactly. And I think based on what you just said there around how important continuing to have that as a integrated solution for us locally is. The more landholders who have done that training, who have got the license for 1080, they can they really sort of respect it and respect the rules, I suppose. Yeah, I think so. Go ahead, Greg.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think having such a big changeover in land ownership that I don't think you can assume that your neighbours fully understand their responsibilities because they live in the country. And I think, you know, we shifted out to a hobby farm when I was 13 and we did our best to get to know the neighbours and everything else. But in the last 15 years in my role in this job, we're seeing a lot more land ownership changes from, you know, primary production-focused ownership to lifestyle, hobby farmers, people that can work remotely. And I think... There's still that assumption in the bush that because you're buying a block of land in the bush, you're from the bush and you know what your responsibilities are. I don't think we can assume that anymore. So I think opening that dialogue and that communication and just letting people know that, you know, look, you know, this is the situation. We run sheep. We really appreciate if you kept your dogs tied up and this and that and yada, yada. I mean, as diplomatically as possible, I don't think you can assume that the people moving in next to you understand what it means to live in the country, particularly with foxes and feral animals and things like that. So, don't assume anything and take the first step if you've got new neighbours.
I love that. And it really kind of continues on with that education element, you know, let's sort of, you know, ask first and perhaps shoot second.
Yeah. Correct.
It's always good advice. Talking of information and education, you mentioned there that, you know, if you go looking for it, it's there. So where would you suggest people go, regardless of where they're from? I'm thinking these resources would help regardless of geographically where people might from. So where can people go?
Correct. So nationally we have a webpage called Pest Smart, and that contains all the current best practice across a range of vertebrate pests. So not just wild dogs and foxes, but rabbits, feral pigs, goats. So that would be a stop. It contains, as I said, all the different guides and different management techniques. It will then also then direct you to the relevant state agency or statutory authority that's responsible in that state. So that gives you an opportunity to have a look at that. Mm-hmm. It also has a lot of the research that we base this best practice on as well. So it gives you a bit of a broader overview. From a wild dog management perspective, so the National Wild Dog Action Plan has its own webpage, www.wilddogplan.org.au, .org it is. I can forward that information on, but that's it has a range of information about best practice, about working in groups. We've got a whole heap of media there about case studies and best practice. It also
it's
has
pretty
a lot
regular because I know Kim sends me
Kim Woods,
yeah. It's fabulous. Yeah. And thank you very much to Kim, who's very much helped us get this far, Greg. So it's
really and that's the thing. It's all about information. Information is power. And I think it became very apparent to me in my earlier days in this role that people weren't being informed of who was doing what. And when your income's being torn to shreds in front of your face, in front of your eyes, and you don't know what the neighbour's doing or what parks are doing or what so-and-so's doing, then you assume they're doing bugger all.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you just get wound up and the stress levels increase and finally someone blows their stack. So this is all about information sharing. And I was just going to say on our National Wild Dog Action Plan webpage, there's actually a research tab where we've got a whole heap of research about, you know, what a dingo is, whether it's a dog, whether it's a species, what their roles are in the environment, about 1080, the not in target species, you know, the benefits of using it. So there's a whole range of things. We've tried to make it as balanced as possible. We've got, you know, the papers that support and defend and that sort of thing. So if people are interested, I think, you know, it's a really good resource to have a look at that. And then, of course, there's the feral scan site. So if you're interested in, you know, what the distribution of pests looks like around the country and what in your local patch and things like that. And then you can get actively involved as a citizen scientist and record information on the app on your phone and do it as well online if you like. So I think there's a number of avenues to get that information at a national scale, and then you have the opportunity to drill down locally following those links to get where you need to go.
Yeah, love it. That's great, Greg. Thank you. And I'll pop all those URLs in the show notes for everyone so that they've got them as well. Great stuff.
Absolutely.
Well, Greg, thank you so much. It's been so good talking to you. I really appreciate it. And I mean, we're very lucky to have someone like you who's kind of dedicated their life to this.
Yeah, for the last 15 years anyway. look, I mean, it has been such a ever-changing space, you know, working at that local level with individual groups to then we got regional coordinators now that provide that ongoing support, particularly Victoria and other places, working with other people to build their skills. And look, it is quite gratifying and satisfying when, you know, you go back to areas and you know how stressed people were to see how relaxed they are now with dog control and fox control. If you're in Mansfield, we've got a producer group called Less Predators, More Lambs.
So you
become a member of that and participate in that. And I can forward the links there. So,
great stuff.
Certainly has
Thank
been
you.
Rewarding.
Worries. Oh, that's great. Thank you so much, Greg. Really appreciate it.
No worries, Jill. Thanks for your time. Cheers, mate.
Question or comment that you'd like to share, or story, or even a tip that would be good for other Sheep Show podcast listeners to know about. Get in touch via Instagram at Holston Valley Farm or email jill@holstonvalleyfarm.com.au. And until next time, sheep well.